this is where I wander out and let down that introduction. Thank you very much. It's great to be back at Bournemouth, this time with the professor's hat on. It's especially great to have one of my first mentors in the room, Roger Lawton, who was one of the first person who got me down the train tracks from Waterloo. So it's nice to be back, Roger, years later. And thank you for the first invitation, and thank you for the invitation this evening. If you haven't read your homework, the tiny, tiny legible writing up there, I'll read it for you. The title and the sort of topic of the lecture is essentially about attention and about how getting people to pay for attention is kind of the pivotal question for the media industries going forwards, and broadly speaking, how some of them are reacting to that challenge and how others are taking it more easily in their stride. This is the inaugural, so it's got to be the first lecture. So I suspect it will be more full of questions than it is of answers, which makes it a pretty good model and a pretty good reflection of my professional and daily life, particularly as a father of two children under three, for whom the question why is now absolutely paramount. So I started on this slide here defining the word attention, or I didn't. William James, who is the author of the kind of default book about psychology for undergraduates, did, which is the tiny writing you can't read. So it says, everyone knows what attention is. It's the taking possession by the mind in clear and vivid form of one out of what seem several simultaneous possible objects or trains of thought. It implies withdrawal from some things in order to deal effectively with others. And it is a condition which has a real opposite in the confused, dazed, scatterbrained state, which in French is called distraction and Zerstreuheit in German. If you'd now think I'm even slightly clever because I managed to read that out and it had some French and some German in it, what you should know is that's the top of the article in Wikipedia when you type in attention. So what made me look a bit clever to my dad actually was really easy, because it just involved typing into a search engine the word attention. What made me slightly less doltish than perhaps I am is the ability to decide that that was a relevant quote for my speech. So most of this evening is going to be about how you know useful things from not useful things, how you know valid things from invalid things, and how you try and decide what you should pay attention to. Because actually it's dead easy to get a quote from William James. It's actually really easy to get one from Proust. I'm quite fond of chucking a Proust quote on the screen. I didn't make it past the second paragraph of A la recherche du temps perdu. I'm not expecting to anytime soon, but if I want to look clever, it's dead easy to get Proust out to do it for me. The skills we need going forwards and the skills that media companies need are about understanding where attention is allocated, why it's allocated there, and what to do to try and create what you might call attention traps. Some bits of the media know how to do that better than others. So what is this paying attention idea about? Well, paying attention is about choices. Most of what I'm going to talk about this evening, which will range lightly across bits of economics that I've picked up at the regulator at Ofcom, where economics is a kind of, is it a religion? It's a dismal science, definitely. Sometimes it's a religion. So I will range across a bit of economics through to things I actually know something about from bitter experience of mainly getting them wrong as a professional in the media, through to some things I really care about, like learning, like actually, of all things, art and creativity. But I'm going to start with choices. To pay attention, you've got to make choices, and choices are based on information, based on what's presented in front of you. Not all of them. Sometimes you just react. Sometimes you don't think about things at all. But in the context of media, most choices are based on some kind of information. I'm going to talk a lot about what I think are misreadings of the place of information, the importance of information in our society, and particularly about some people I'm going to call information fundamentalists, who are the people at the more geeky end of the spectrum that I work with, who believe that if you just have enough information, good things will necessarily result. And there's a great history of these kind of technological utopianists. If you read a book called The Victorian Internet by Tom Standage about the arrival of the telegraph, you will read wonderful pronouncements about how the ability to communicate more quickly was going to end all war, when in fact it just made it a great deal more efficient to decide where you should send your troops, which is not quite what the utopians thought. And the problem about that is that technologies are used by people. Choices are made by people. And of course they are. Unfortunately, we don't behave in a terribly rational way quite a lot of the time, and we seldom use technologies for what the inventors originally envisaged. But that doesn't stop information fundamentalism, and it doesn't stop the valid and measurable rise of information. We've heard phrases, the information society, the networked economy, these kind of jargon phrases that you hear a great deal about the world we now live in, the digital world of information that surrounds us. And we've heard about those topics essentially from a sort of category of people who are predominantly selling a vision of the future, but doesn't make some of these things untrue. My phrase for the internet this evening, I'm not going to use it a lot, will be to describe it as the ultimate copying machine. Everything the internet does is about creating copies. Your email is copied multiple times between when you press send and the microsecond or however long it is that it takes to arrive in your computer. Every file that is shared across the internet is copied multiply, perfectly, in something approaching real time and in something approaching no marginal cost, zero marginal cost. What we've invented is the perfect copying machine to a large extent, and the perfect copying machine wouldn't be any use if it wasn't good at spreading copies around the place. What we haven't yet understood is the implications of the perfect copying machine for the old way of doing things, or some people have understood it and some people are grappling with it at the moment. The second thing we're grappling with, I believe, is a shift from a world in which the power of distribution, the power of creation lay with large groups, large organisations, to a position now where, as a creator of media, I think about what I call the focus group of one. The one person, the person formerly known as the audience, a member of that group, who is turning up at my website, playing my game, interacting with my proposition, my work in some shape or form. The reason I think about them is because the internet isn't made up of audiences that turn up at 7:30 every Tuesday regardless. It doesn't respect time, it doesn't respect geography, and so every user, every person arriving, reacts individually to my work. That didn't matter so much when they were consuming media work. It matters a great deal when they're making choices based on information about what to do with it. Most web pages I make, and I've made hundreds of millions of them in my career now, are seen by almost nobody for almost no time at all. That's quite a leveling notion as a creative. Most people turn up to most websites, and what they're looking for is the next thing to do to allow them to leave. That's very, very different to a notion of keeping people embedded within a linear story. It's very different to my original world, working in the theatre, where generally speaking, the act of departing is quite a big statement. The act of departing a website is a default thing. It's what you do. And creating in that space is a very difficult and very different place to creating in the linear spaces, which are, by the way, just as difficult, but in different ways. What I'm driving at here is that the skills of one are not necessarily transferable to the other. The good news is just about anybody under 28, 29 doesn't see the difference between those two things in any case, and therefore will be shortly taking over jobs like mine. And that's great news, and as long as I can retire before that happens, please. The group of people who believe this stuff more than anything are the people I referred to already, the information fundamentalists. People who believe that if there's just more stuff, if there's more information, if there's more computing power, it will automatically result in better societies, in better life, in better experience. Now, I may just not be able to do the maths here. I may just not be able to think on the long term. But I read a bit of science fiction, and I read a lot of other things, and I can foresee a conceptual world in which we have sentient machines and conscious computers. I can foresee all that stuff, kind of hoping to be long dead before we get there. But I can't see the maths that far. I'm not good enough at that. I'm in this kind of bridging world, as I believe we all are, between messy, irrational, complicated people and messy, irrational, complicated information. I don't believe that we have anything approaching the information networks we will have. I don't believe we have anything approaching the search and discovery capabilities that we will have. Google are fond of saying they think they've cracked search maybe 5%. I think they'd be lucky if it's that much as time goes on. So search and discovery are big challenges. And I come back to information. The reason I don't believe this idea that just the more information, the better, is because I was brought up by one of my other mentors in the room, Professor Stephen Heppel, to believe that there were different categories of information. There was data, which is just basic stuff, and there's masses of that around. Exabytes of it, billions of gigabytes of it around. But data only became useful when you put it in some form of context where it made sense to you, and then it became information. It informed you in some shape or form. Data isn't valuable, data is just noisy. I was once asked by a journalist, what do you think about the fact that the BBC says it has 2 million websites? And I said, I thought that was a curse, not a boast. Way too much stuff with no relevance isn't that beneficial. Information, however, has some value to me because I can do things with it, and then it allows me to try and turn it into knowledge, and if I'm really, really lucky, to turn knowledge into wisdom. Wikipedia is great for information. The decision to choose that quote is in some way about knowledge. If it turns out to be enlightening in some shape or form in a few years' time, it might turn out that there was some tiny grain of wisdom in there. I'm not saying there is yet, but who can tell? So these notions that information and data have values embedded within them are really important to me, because they're what I base the decisions I make creatively on. They're what I base the people I work with on, people who see these kind of distinctions. Go back to the information fundamentalist for a little while. It's really, really easy to see the theory of information and the completeness that the internet appears to give to some kinds of information. But actually, the internet is mainly holes. The internet is mainly stuff you don't find. Google is mainly a list of hundreds of millions of search results that are not of interest to you, with some that are marginally less not of interest to you at the top. It's not in any way a system for finding, it's a system for searching. There's a very important difference between finding and searching. Finding, at the moment, mainly involves human beings and a bit of searching. You're much more likely to find something of interest if your friend tells you it's interesting than just by randomly searching Google, or if it's socially bookmarked, or whatever it is. And at the moment, we're in this blended space, and I think the moment is going to last quite a long time. But that doesn't stop information theorists. It doesn't stop theories of all kinds. It doesn't stop the information fundamentalists. And it doesn't stop this thing which I'm going to call the curse of neatness, the idea that you can have a theory, a kind of straightforward little theory that'll explain this incredibly complicated environment. Any more, for instance, than it's turning out, or maybe we'll be wrong, but maybe it's not turning out, that you could have something called the efficient markets hypothesis, that you could explain stock markets in this rather simplistic way that said, well, as long as everybody has perfect information, you can never beat the market, and there can't be a boom or a bust because we'll all have perfect information. This came up the Chicago School of Economists in the 70s, since when we know they may not turn out to be as right as they thought they were. Markets just don't work like that, because they're very much more complicated than the simplistic, neat theory. Media's the same. It's not Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan is drawing a rough map, 50 years ago nearly, of what the ecosystem might now look like. You've got a real live experiment every day in the internet that tells you what the market and what the media environment does increasingly look like. So oversimplification is the enemy here. Trying to get a sort of all-encompassing theory that along the lines of the efficient markets hypothesis might work for a little while, but and in the end I think it's more helpful to think about the issues and to be reflexive about them, to be conscious of them. So let's kill a few of the media buzzwords that float around the place, including in some of the textbooks. Martini media. Who's heard of martini media? Okay, a few people. Martini media is a kind of voguish term thrown around by predominantly people from broadcasters who kind of have children who've been on the internet. It's a belief that you'll just have all media anytime, any place, anywhere. The people over sort of 35 in the room now understand why it's called martini media. Everybody else is going, no, what's that about? There was a drink called martini. There still is a drink called martini. It comes in terrible bottles, or it's mixed very expensively by bartenders. And there was an advertising campaign with Joan Collins, is that right? With Joan Collins, who was a soap star. That's a kind of actress. Just keep going for a minute. This was the catchphrase, anytime, any place, anywhere, which I always thought was a bit optimistic. Martini, 6 a.m., just got up, bacon sandwich, martini. It always struck me as being a bit of a strange idea in any case. This is kind of one of the great sort of, this is supposed to indicate that you understand the way the media is going if you're from the traditional media industry. The only problem with it is it's arrant nonsense. Because you don't want the same media anytime, any place, anywhere, because it doesn't match what you're doing. It makes a lot of sense if you're distributing media, because it's a great deal better than no time, no place, nowhere, which is the alternative, but it doesn't make much sense as a user. Do you really want to have whatever's being pumped out of a commercial television channel on your phone just at the same time it's being pumped out, because that makes sense for the television channel, or do you want the thing you want? I want the thing I want. It's fairly straightforward. So it's another sort of oversimplification, this idea that just getting technology to be able to take media onto any platform is necessarily good for users. I've lost count of the number of mobile TV trials there have been, the amount of companies that have sort of tried to make these things work just because the technology can do it. Martini Media doesn't really help. Third one, almost every technological guru you'll ever read reads way too much science fiction and believes it. But they believe in it as a place, as an endpoint, when I think most science fiction, good science fiction, is incredibly informative about the kind of journey we might be on. But it's not really an endpoint. I'm not that good at physics, but The Matrix seems quite unlikely in the near future. But it tells you quite a lot of useful things about the way in which networks and human societies might be going. Actually, if you want to read stuff that is kind of informative, read the work of Cory Doctorow, who's a sort of technological thinker and science fiction writer who actually works in the technology world now. Or obviously William Gibson, these sorts of guys. But don't think they're trying to describe the world in 2040 or 2050. They're trying to describe aspects of the direction of travel the world might be going in. In fact, many of the good ones are satirists, in the same way that Jonathan Swift was a satirist. They're not trying to describe it. They're trying to undermine our direction of travel by pointing out some of the things we don't know or some of the things that are ridiculous about what we're doing. But actually, quite a lot of technological people believe science fiction. That's okay. But it doesn't help much in the long run, I don't think. That's facetious, that part, by the way, obviously. The other thing that worries me is oversimplification again. What somebody else, not me, called information Newtonianism. Believing that the world is, in fact, as simple as Newton's description of physics, when, in fact, the ecosystem of media is more like the chaos theory of Mandelbrot or the quantum theory of Einstein and et al. I'm at that end, and I don't understand any of the physics. But I know it's more complicated than it used to be when you made a television program, distributed it through television channels, and people watched it on a Saturday night. Some of the time, it's more complicated than that. So trying to find simplicity here, I think, is worrying. So another great example of simplicity is what Nicholas Negroponte, in Being Digital, one of the kind of founding texts of my world, 1995, Stephen, something like that. Negroponte is professor at MIT. What he called the divide between bits and atoms, or I'm going to call it bits and bricks, this idea that there were completely separate domains. There was digital and there was non-digital. Well, actually, I think if you start with the person, you start with the individual, there are never separate domains. There are things you do, some of which are digital, some of which are not digital, and many of which span the two spaces over time. So I went crawling Wikipedia again, like you do for these sorts of things, or like I do. So you can be a professor and just look on Wikipedia for stuff, students. It's good. I went crawling Wikipedia again to try and find sort of ideas around this duality between real life and information. And I found Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, who said he was defining work, which I thought was kind of helpful. Work is of two kinds. First, altering the position of matter at or near the Earth's surface relative to other such matter, moving stuff about. Second, telling other people to do so. Information is telling other people to do so. Bits are moving stuff about. Clearly, there are distinctions between these two things, but do they hold up in the digital world as much as the kind of simplicity of that theory might suggest? For the reasons I've said previously, I don't think they do, because I think as human beings, we interact seamlessly between those two spaces. 10 minutes before I came on, I was on Skype with my children, my three-year-old daughter, in fact, who said earlier on in the day, "Daddy, I need to talk to you later on," because she had to show me something she'd made at preschool or whatever it was. And I said, "Well, I'll phone you." And she said, "No, I like to Skype because I can see you. It's better." Which of those, don't say all, although the audience at the time, actually, because she was on the screen, which of those is information, which of those is not? She's bringing the real world of observable evidence, looking at stuff, into the digital world. She can't see that distinction. At three, she wouldn't see that distinction, I suspect, in any case, but she'll never see that distinction in the way that anybody in this room does. It would just not be real for her. And I'm not sure it's as real as we think it is. Is there really a battle or a dichotomy between stuff and information, or not? Well, I think for providers of information, it suits them quite often to perpetuate the idea that there is. That you can have either a DVD or a download, that you can have either a newspaper or a website. I think that's oversimplification again. The fundamental thing for me, and I'll come back to this later, is you need what you need to deliver something of value to you as a user or a participant at that moment. And sometimes, as this morning, that will be a book to read in the bath, and sometimes that will be a much vaunted imminent Apple book reading tablet or whatever it is, or an iPhone. By the way, that's a phone, of course. It's controlling a presentation. When did that happen? Phones just became things that did things about 2 years ago, didn't they? So for providers of content, particularly, they like the idea that there's a balance between the, that there's a battle between these two things, mainly because it kind of often reflects their own companies. There often is a battle between the guys in DVDs and the guys in downloading, the download department, because one of them, DVDs, currently makes more money than the other one and therefore has more sway in the institution. But actually, everybody knows that if they don't start to collaborate and think collectively, in the end, all their revenues will fall away. It doesn't stop them arguing amongst themselves, perpetuating this false idea. Because for you as the focus group of one, do you care whether it's stuff or information? You care deeply when it's relevant. You don't care if it's just the most efficient way for a distributor to send you content. It's vastly cheaper, do you know, for Netflix or one of those DVD rental companies to send you a DVD in the post than it is to download it, to allow you to download it. At this point in time, it is cheaper for them to do the post, although, of course, it might never arrive. It is cheaper for them to do that. So amazingly enough, they perpetuate that model until it makes sense for them to flip to the information model, because the cost of shipping that that data will be too high. I don't think it's anything like simple, and it's anything like that simple, that there is a dichotomy, there's a balance, an argument between bits and bricks. Just seems too simple. And why? Well, they're coming back in again because people mess up the theory. We just don't behave rationally about these things. We are essentially irrational more than we like to think we are. That's not bad. It just happens to be more true than the theorists would believe. It doesn't make a lot of sense to keep books at home on shelves when you have read them and will never read them again. It is an irrational act to have your own private library. It doesn't make it wrong or valueless, it's just not rational. And I think I have 2,000 or 3,000 books. I would count up in this room. There will be many, many hundreds of thousands of books between us. But that is an irrational thing to do. In the context, if it happens, of being able to download every book that's available. Why would you need to keep them? Because they're not just about the information in the books. They remind me of where I was when I read them. They do something wonderful, which is tell people that I've read loads of books when they come to my house. They do something rather interesting when people, whether it's actually games as well, works like that for me. They do something about starting conversations. Used to be albums in the day of some of us in the room. Actually, not me. It was CDs even for me. But they have social value. They have social value as social signifiers that steps beyond their rational, functional capabilities. In a way, what we're seeing is a start of a kind of utilitarian argument about things should be useful against an age-old argument with things should be valuable, and sometimes value comes from usefulness. You can have John Stuart Mill and Wittgenstein 100 years ago having that debate, not quite 100 years ago, 80 years ago having that debate. Still, Mill would be dead, clearly. Wittgenstein would less so, although equally as incomprehensible to most of us. The other reason people mess it up is we're ignorant. We know almost nothing of everything that is to be known. And how would we make these incredible judgments based on the idea that we have perfect information about things? Nobody has perfect information, and even if you did, you would have it for such a tiny amount of time before circumstances changed that it would be imperfect again. This is obvious stuff, that we don't have these kind of simplicity, these elements of simplicity that can make the theories work. But there's one real problem. The book of the year for me was a book called The Origin of Wealth by a writer called Eric Bienhoeffer, which is about economics. It's specifically about a branch of economics called evolutionary economics or complexity economics. And Bienhoeffer's thesis is that we've been misled by the classical economic theory that has been around for so long because it's just more complicated than that. So that kind of it, really. It's just too interconnected, complex, and what he calls reflexive. One thing happens which affects another thing, which affects another thing, which affects another. Reflexivity is the core tenet of George Soros's writings, the multi-billionaire financier, and actually of Warren Buffett's writings about making vast sums of money. They understand the idea that markets are very complex, and somehow, in some form of necromancy, they can ride them. But they don't try to oversimplify them. The media space is like this now. It's complex, it's self-reflexive. Things feed on each other. Ideas feed on each other, content feeds on content around the network. It isn't this simple, you feed it in, a thing happens, you get a result. I'm not sure it ever was, but it's been described that way for so long. That's Einstein against Newton, complexity against the oversimplified model. And I love the fact that it is irrational, that we are ignorant, and that there is complexity. Thank goodness for that, I say, because if it wasn't, I suspect we wouldn't have any art. I'm fairly sure we wouldn't learn very much, and I'm absolutely positive we'd have no adventure or fun. These are the variables, these are the exciting, confusing things that make it worth being here. Wittgenstein and Mill again. And actually, even markets to me seem to prove that these theories don't work. If markets are just really efficient, and they're just about information and the exchange of information, confidence wouldn't matter. Now, I've just become involved in a PLC for the first time in my life, a floated company. Confidence matters a lot. What people think about you is actually vastly more important, it seems, to your stock price than what you do all day. Confidence matters a great deal. Exuberance, when stocks get overexcited or over-pessimistic, that wouldn't matter. And irrationality wouldn't matter. Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the US Federal Reserve, said in a previous mini-bust, as it turned out, that the markets had got irrationally exuberant about dot-com, about investing in the internet. Well, if they're logical beasts of information, they can't be confident, exuberant, or irrational. And yet, whenever they go wrong, they're described as over-exuberant or irrationally exuberant. And then, logically, therefore, you couldn't have booms and busts, which is clearly evidenced very well by recent history. And what about content? If content was so simple, if content was all there was to media, just getting the idea from my brain to yours, that'd be dead easy. Why would we bother with theatres? Because I could just tell you the story. It'd be straightforward. You bother with theatres because of a shared experience among people in a room. You bother with theatres because you, as individual members of the audience, can make your decision about what you want to focus on, what you want to pay attention to. You don't just go to the theatre to find out the ending. Or if you do, let me tell you, you're missing a few bits about theatre. What about cinemas? I was once asked by an MP, and obviously not a paragon of questing intellectual rigour, how long cinemas had got. And this was I was actually giving evidence at a select committee. And he said, you know about this new technology stuff, how long have cinemas got? And sort of the question made its way into my head through eventually. And I thought, I have no idea what he's talking about. And he said, well, because now we've all got plasma screens, enormous plasma screens in our home and surround sound systems. How long have cinemas got? You don't need cinemas. We've got brilliant pictures, brilliant sound. And I had a moment of what they call esprit d'escalier, which is when you don't think of the right thing to say at the time, but you think of it on the way down the stairs, esprit d'escalier, on the way out, which is I wanted to say to him, have you got a kitchen? Do you ever go to restaurants? Why the hell have you got a kitchen then? Because he was doing this sort of techno-utopian thing. Because the technology is great, of course, that will delete out the alternative, which was seen as going to the cinema. I go to the cinema when I go to sit in a room full of 500 people getting thrilled or laughing or whatever it is. And probably because the screen's that bit bigger, because not many of us actually have screens that big. Although, of course, I'm not claiming them on my expenses, so who can tell what size his plasma screen was. But whichever you go, it's a social thing, it's a human thing, it's a messy thing, it's about popcorn, it's about snogging at the back. It is also about the film. This kind of functionalist perspective doesn't help. Just the information in the film. Did what happens in 2012? Did the Olympics happen in despite of the fact the entire world is collapsing in that film? I don't know. If content was rational, if media was rational, can you anybody in the room explain John and Edward to me? Because if it was all about the experience of the content, If it was all about the experience of, let's be honest, absolutely anything at all, apart from the fact that the British love taking the piss out of Simon Cowell and love an underdog and love subverting things that feel self-important and have confused X Factor with Britain's Got Talent, which I think is probably pretty fair, because you tell me the difference between Stavros Flatley and John and Edward, apart from the fact they're on the wrong programme. But whichever ones of those it is, so you don't get John and Edward in professorship letters very often, I hope, whichever one it is, it's not about just the stuff they're getting across, the idea, the content. Whatever we're doing it as a society or as individuals about them, at least as much as encountering what they're doing. And for me, that's because it's not about content. Where we are now is not about content, it's about experiences that you have, that I have, as a viewer, as a game player, as a participant, as somebody singing in a choir. I'm doing a big, invented a big participatory singing project the BBC are doing at the moment, trying to get 500 scratch choirs to sing the Hallelujah chorus, using the internet, but singing it in real life. It's about experiences. And experiences for me, and this is only for me, have value when they're personal, when they're meaningful, i.e. when they make some sense for me, when they add something to my life, and that's because I need to value them in one form or another. And that is a personal decision. It's a personal set of circumstances. It isn't something that I will share with everybody. It's something, these are characteristics that some media will sometimes bring together large numbers of people around, and we'll come back in a little while to the overblown death of television. Pretty odd medium where 14 million people are watching The X Factor. It's an odd dying medium if 14 million people are watching it on a Saturday and Sunday night. Television's not going anywhere in some ways, but it's going totally down the drain in others. And as soon as we understand the difference, people in telly might have a chance. But it's about these things, more often than not, that are personal or valuable to me. I suspect many of you watch The X Factor for different reasons to the reasons I watch The X Factor, and that is the way that media consumption and the reading of media experiences always have been. The difference for me now is that we're moving from a position where most of us were essentially in a rationed environment of media, a situation where media was relatively scarce, to the situation we're now in where it is almost ubiquitous. There is so much media around us that the onus is shifting from waiting to be fed media, gratefully waiting with the curtains closed for Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, for an episode of Doctor Who. There's an episode of Doctor Who. I talked to Andrew's in the room, he knows a bit about Doctor Who. I worked on Doctor Who last year for a while. There's an episode of Doctor Who in series two or three with Maureen Lipman, you're gonna tell me which now, in the new series with Maureen Lipman, who infects the nation's televisions on the day of the Queen's coronation. And takes over the televisions. You do know, don't you? It's called The Idiot's Lantern. The Idiot's Lantern, thank you. I don't know whether to be proud or ashamed that you know that. Actually, I know which I don't have to be, because I didn't know that. The Idiot's Lantern. And on the day, in 1953 of the coronation, this whole episode takes place. Well, actually, the thing I found most interesting about it, talking to the children of teenage children and youngish children of friends, was that they were completely mystified by the idea that people would gather around a television programme. Utterly confused them. And people did. People, you know, that's one of my dad's early experiences of television. They had the first colour TV in the street. People came and watched TV in their room. It just doesn't have that draw. It doesn't have that mythos. It doesn't have that history. What we do now, instead of waiting for it to be fed, is sometimes it is so enormous. The next coronation of the queen, of a king, well, it'd be a king, of a king in this country probably, will be bigger than the last in numerical numbers watching television. By a country mile, it will be bigger than the last. But that's because it will be, the characteristics of that event will be so big and unmissable, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, that television will be one of the only ways to do them justice. But actually for most of us, most of our media consumption is about searching out content. It's about seeking out experiences in our lives, online, on TV, at the library, at the football, travelling. We're empowered increasingly to find these things for ourselves. We are doing the filtering. We as users, as people formerly known as the audience, we're doing the filtering now. And that's a very different balance from where we were. One of the great ironies of information economics, which is what this discipline is called, is that while information can be trivially copied and information bandwidth continues to widen, the individual's attention span or bandwidth is as narrow as ever. It's not strictly true in the mathematical sense of how many bits of media can you be present at simultaneously. There's some fascinating research, in fact, which Professor Heppel was involved in, into how much you can pay attention to. The way we spread and direct our attention is changing. You might well be looking at a Twitter stream, surfing the web, radio in the background, television happening, etc. But actually what you'll be doing is switching more quickly because you've only got one focal point. And that's not me, that's the human brain. There are backgrounds, there are things you can do to improve your background processing capability, but you'll only have one focal point of attention. And the key thing is to decide what you don't watch, what you don't listen to in that context. And in that environment, choices are really, really important. Because in an information-rich world, as somebody called Mr. Simon said in 1971, the wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a scarcity of whatever it is that information consumes. What information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. And a need to allocate that attention efficiently among the overabundance of information sources that might consume it. It's too much stuff. And that leads us to the position I think we're in today. As we shift from a situation of scarcity of information to abundance of information, there are essentially two challenges in the digital media age for media professionals and for us as media consumers. Polar challenges, opposite ends of the spectrum. Finding and being found. And finding and being found are essentially descriptions of the getting and giving, or the giving and getting, to be strictly correct, of attention. It's not search, it's not channels, it's finding and being found. Almost every film ever made is watched by almost nobody. Almost every magazine ever printed is read by almost nobody and is known about by almost nobody on the grand scheme of things. Your biggest problem as a creator is not how to make your stuff seen by everybody, it is how to avoid it being seen by nobody. It is a levelling fact of life. In a simple system, it wasn't like that. In a simple system, let's go back to the 1950s in television, attention was quite straightforward. What you had was a situation in which Ed Murrow, the legendary journalist, said, just because your voice reaches halfway around the world doesn't mean you are wiser than when it reached only to the end of the bar. Television could do that. It could amplify you in that way. Television sometimes still can do that. It can amplify people in that way. But actually, just because you had a stranglehold on the distribution or the production didn't necessarily mean you had things worth saying. Just because 28 million people watched Morecambe and Wise on Christmas Day 1977 doesn't mean there was nothing they could conceivably think of watching better. It just means there wasn't a lot else on. Doesn't denigrate from Morecambe and Wise, but it isn't the same as the environment now. Now, some people immediately leap here and say, well, that means loud media, big media, they're dead. Well, that's nonsense. In fact, if anything, right now, loudness is more important than ever. If you're in the big media, if you're in television, the most important thing you can be right now is noticed. If you're loud, loudness is more important than it ever has been. If you own the rights to Formula One, the price of them is going up. If you own the rights to the Premiership football, the price is going up. If you create a massive hit drama, not so much like The Wire because it was a niche hit drama, but a major drama that hits around the world, or a format like The X Factor. I encountered Simon Fuller, one of the people behind The X Factor, the other day. They're suggesting it's worth $1 billion a year now. The value of successful loud things is much greater than it ever has been because they're more global, they're more instantaneous, they spread across more platforms, you can get money out of them in other ways. Loudness, if anything, is more important than ever. But the problem is, it turns out that a lot of the stuff we thought was important just turns out to have been loud. There's no real scarcity in programmes to fill the gap between midday and 3 p.m. Go and look at the schedule of ITV or Channel 4, and then look at the schedule of the same channels in the 1970s. Some of the same programmes are showing up in those dead, quiet gaps. Doesn't mean you can't make loud, wonderful things for those spaces, but maybe they're not valuable enough. Maybe they're not turning up enough cash. Maybe quite a lot of the problem with television is there's too much of it, rather than that it's not good enough. But that's a difficult thing to say to somebody from television. It's also a difficult thing to say to somebody from newspapers, particularly from the tabloids. We'll come on to, briefly, Rupert Murdoch's announcements about putting paywalls up around newspapers in a little while. I was briefly News International Professor of Media at another university. There's nothing to say about that, I just was. They didn't want to hear this argument. They just didn't want to hear anything about this stuff. And they still don't. And that's fine. Jeff Zucker, NBC Universal, one of the biggest names in television, he said, Google was built on the power of math. I think he meant maths. Math and algorithms. I think he's American. NBC is built on brilliant programming. Both are compelling models, but I don't think Google's model is as powerful as Viacom, blah, blah, and as the market would have you believe. There's one minor problem with that. It's total nonsense. It's trying to compare apples with oranges. It's like saying, oh, well, actually, the water companies who distribute water, which is a necessity of life, have a different model to NBC, but NBC is better. At what? It's not the same thing. That's not to say there is no value in NBC. If you watch 30 Rock or you watch a number of the other things that come out of NBC, you know that they create incredible television from time to time. But to compare it against Google is to take the wrong place. It's to take the wrong point in the argument and then just get it completely wrong. It just doesn't work, that argument, because Google doesn't do what television does. And there's a lot of this around at the moment, unnecessarily urgent in my view, quite often. What the theorists call last gasp theory. Just as the technology is reaching its end, it turns out to be quite good at being what it was good at. Just as everybody is worrying about the death of television, some people focus on making great television, and there's some great television around the place. And there will continue to be great television around the place. It's last gasp theory. Surely much better to focus on doing what you were brilliant at well than trying to do the alternative, which is what, for instance, the music industry did for quite a long time, which is to take your old way of operating and bring it into the new world. For instance, by trying to reintroduce scarcity. Once music got free, once we could just download music, once it became something that was on the network, you were never going to win by trying to reintroduce the idea that you would put digital rights management, DRM, onto music, and it'd be very, very hard to download that, because you were up against something for which it was not very, very hard to download. And before you know it, it takes a technologist in Steve Jobs at Apple to bang the music industry's heads and get them to remove DRM, get them to remove that only plays on your iPod, can only be transferred to a CD by somebody who's got a PhD in law to read the thing that comes with it, that is the click legals and all that other stuff. That's not going with the direction of consumer travel. That was trying to reintroduce scarcity. Reintroduce scarcity around a product where the value was no longer in the physical distribution of a DVD or a CD. It's somewhere else, and we'll come back to where. And we've got somebody doing it at the moment. Mr. Murdoch's touching belief, I shouldn't say that's terribly rude, isn't it, in the value of his product. I buy it for movies. I buy it for high-value content, financial content. Briefly, I buy it for exclusive content, and we'll come back to some of the other categories later. I don't buy it for a picture of Katie Price coming out of a nightclub. That picture will be available wherever shortly. Only if you've got products which, generally speaking, have some aspect of uniqueness around them, can you put up a wall and ask people to pay around it. People are not going to die in a ditch to pay for the Sun if they can get the same content free somewhere else. It's just not going to happen. That doesn't mean he won't try. I don't think it's about paying on the internet, by the way. I think it's about forcing people to buy newspapers for just as long as possible before they stop doing that in large numbers. We'll see if it turns out to be true. As you may tell, I don't share his belief in the value of his products in the digital space. So let's take another intuitive leap. Surely that means I'm saying that all information should be free. Off charge? Don't know. Well, define free is the first question. I do believe there shouldn't be artificial barriers put up around getting hold of content. That doesn't mean it has to be free. That doesn't mean it has to generate no value. Define free. Do you mean free speech? I do. It should be free. It should be freely available and accessible. But I don't mean free beer. Free beer would lead to the collapse of the Western civilization as we know it. It would also lead to the collapse of industries like brewing and the hospitality industry and bottling and all sorts of other industries. Free speech is very different from free beer. And the enemies of this, the proponents of simplicity, rather, in this debate, like to pretend they're the same. The idea that content should be readily accessible easily available is not the same as the idea that it should never be charged for, or that it should never have any value attached to it. I used to be a board member of Creative Commons, the rights organisation. I'm a lawyer by background. Those sorts of simplistic arguments just aren't helping. What's the best thing we could do to copyright, for instance? The best thing we could do to copyright is flip the model from saying all rights reserved, so that if you're a user, if you're a documentary maker in this school, you have to go and ask permission from all kinds of people to show things. Is to flip the model from all rights reserved, which was fine when it was a few big companies talking to each other, to some rights reserved, everything else is fine. So to say what you can do with content, rather than just say you can't do anything unless you ask my permission. If you're managing a three-year-old like that, you would have a very, very busy day. If you took literally every decision on the face of it, and that three-year-old never learned to chunk information to allow decisions of their own, you would have one almightily bad life. That's where copyright is. It's in a dysfunctional situation where the costs of getting hold of copyright are too high and are standing in the face of what's happening on digital networks. And what happens when these circumstances arise? People simply root round it, and they do what they were going to do anyway. Surely something better that can track the value, that can track the way copyright moves, is the way we've got to go. This whole free debate, in fact, is absolutely full of these false oppositions. There's a book called Free, is it called Free, by Chris Anderson? Something like that, which sort of takes you through these ideas that, you know, free is the new whatever the catchphrase was, but this idea that free is a radical price, I think is the catchphrase. Well, maybe it is, and we'll come back to some other thoughts in a moment. But it's not an opposition. The content industries have been giving stuff away free for decades for their own reasons. There was a whole channel called MTV, there still is, a whole family of channels called MTV, which built rather a successful business model on the promotional content of another industry, the music industry. There was a, there still is, just about, an organisation in the US that produced a magazine called TV Guide, which was nothing more than a listings magazine, but in a country the size of the US, that was quite a big deal. I'm reliably informed that there was at least one year in which the profits of TV Guide were greater than the profits of all the American television networks combined. And yet they were giving away free information. False oppositions, oversimplicity. What they mask is an argument about what we value and who's in charge, who controls it. And this is where the shift is happening. But again, let's not oversimplify. There is a shift going on between distribution and discovery, between being able to push content out and helping people find it. If Google, as somebody said, is a database of the world's unfulfilled desires, which I quite like, you type it in and Google helps you find it. Imperfectly, but better, the least worst option. As a colleague of mine, Ashley Highfield, once said, I don't really want to watch a movie on a tiny, tiny 6-inch screen that's moving around like this while I'm trying to watch it. But if the alternative is staring out the window in an aeroplane for 8 hours, it's the least worst thing I've got in front of me. Google's the least worst search engine. If power is shifting from distribution to discovery, that's a big deal. But the theorists and the information fundamentalists will say at that point, so that's it. The old model of distribution is dead. So don't write distribution off just yet. My colleague at the back, Rob Morgan, did a bit of research for me. Thank you, Rob. We have charted the revenues of red is total UK television advertising, 2004-2008. Blue is the UK revenues of Google. Now, on one model, that says, oh my God, be very afraid, look how big Google is and look how quickly it's going. And that is good and an important thing to think about. But television executives are absolutely terrified that Google is eating their lunch. That red number's staying surprisingly solid at the top. Now, that doesn't mean it will continue to stay surprisingly solid, but it's another sort of Jeff Zuckerism. The revenue out of UK television advertising is about £3 billion a year. And Google, admittedly, is rising very quickly to over a couple of billion in the UK, which is quite big, but it's actually not killing distribution yet. The more subtle story is that what's happening in television advertising is the value of it is moving into different slots in different parts of the schedule. So they're predicting, I don't know if it'll be true, that the ad slots in the final episode or the final sing-off of The X Factor will be £250,000 each. I've no idea how big that is compared to 10 years ago, but my hunch is much bigger than it would have been for most things. But at the same time, there are television channels in the UK where we have a massive oversupply of television channels in general, which can't fill their slots. So what you're seeing is not total destruction of one by the other. You're seeing a reallocation going on inside these two massive, massive and important markets. And that's because when big media, when it helps you find attention and deliver mass audiences, it's getting more valuable. But at the same time, tailored search type advertising is of greater value and greater significance to audiences and users than it ever has been previously. The money's coming from somewhere, but it doesn't yet look like it's coming out of television. So when you hear that dichotomy, it might just turn out to be false. So finally, to sort of wrap up, broadly speaking, how do we react to this as individuals? Well, the theory, the kind of jargon of this would be, how do we find value? How do we decide what to pay attention to? So I said, I paraphrased the title of this slide as finding value, or how real people pay with attention. I think of adverts and television programs as an attention tax. I've turned up to watch a television program, and now you're going to make me watch 2.5 minutes of adverts for the privilege. I flip through them with a PVR. I get them in another form. I get content in another form on DVD or on online. I watch the last ad in break more than I ever did, which, by the way, is usually a promotion for the television broadcaster, because that's the one I know to press play on. So paradoxically, the last ad in a television break is getting more valuable, not less, as more of us skip ads. Anybody noticed how much more vibrant ads are getting to catch your attention? How they're using comedy? How their ads are changing around us to start catching attention back again, trapping attention back again. But they're not just taxing it because we're only there. I'm not sure they ever were. Otherwise, what about all those potentially apocryphal stories about how the National Grid always had to cope with when everybody turned their kettles on in the advertising break on Coronation Street? If we were all engrossed in Coronation Street, who was turning the kettles on? So I'm not entirely sure it was ever different, actually, but I think the difference is being exacerbated and scaled. So where do we find value? Well, here's a few thoughts. A lot of these, by the way, some of these are kind of drawn from the work of somebody called Kevin Kelly, who's the founding editor of Wired magazine, who has, he calls them generatives, these sorts of ideas. He has more of them because he's cleverer. Although it could be that famous phrase that, sorry, I wrote you such a long letter, I didn't have time to write you a short one. Kevin Kelly throws out, you know, as these theorists do, lots of stuff. But anyway, first one, if something is novel, if it's new, first night of something, it's fascinating to watch as kids from the digital media and on-demand universe get used to the fact that there just won't be Doctor Who until Saturday next week. And that's the way it is. Not sure that's a good thing, but it ascribes a certain kind of value for as long as you can hang on to that scarcity. I think that's going to collapse quite quickly. I think what will happen is people will start paying more to be given things earlier. Or it's about now. The plane hits the towers. If a bomb goes off in central London, the value is now. The value is immediate and knowledgeable information which you trust. If it's a football match, unless you are really very obsessed indeed, you're probably not watching those goals back the following morning. The half-life of Match of the Day for me is around about 6 or 8 hours before I inadvertently find out what's happened when I'm trying to do it like that. We live in fear in my house of finding anything out about the X Factor or Strictly Come Dancing on the grounds that we've got tiny children. We can't watch television at 6 and 7 o'clock on Saturday night. So we don't listen to radio, we don't pick up newspapers. We should get out more, sorry about that. But whichever way that goes, the truth of it is we don't want to find out because it would spoil the experience to some extent. Actually, this year it doesn't because we're not bothered about either of them who wins, to be honest now. But that's just this year. But there is something about, you know, novelty and timeliness. There's something about personal content, which is deeply relevant to you. You might pay. You probably will give it more attention. If it's personalised, maybe. I don't know. We just got given a terrible christening gift for our son, a CD. And they obviously haven't met us, this particular part of the family. A CD of nursery rhymes with his name in them. So I don't know if it's Jack and Tom went up the hill. I've no idea how they do it because I've not dared to listen, to be completely honest. But there's something in there about personalising it, isn't there? I don't know. There's something in there about making it personal to me. On the web, of course there is. Amazon recommendations, Spotify playlists. That's about personal. That's about something that I would value. I'll pay for that. Might not pay very much, but I will pay something for it. I want truthfulness. I want authenticity. I want what they used to call quality. Some of my life, I'm a broadcasting regulator. We're not allowed to say quality because that's a value-laden term, and that's correct. But I do want truth. I do want authenticity. And I'll pay for those in some way, whether it's to watch ads. But there is value there for me, which I would ascribe to those. And sometimes I'm really grateful. I know people who paid for the Radiohead album just because they thought it was the right thing to do. There's a deep human psychology that says, I want to pay tribute to these people. I'm going to bow before them. And sometimes you'll do that with money. Sometimes. Not for most bands. Not most of the time. But sometimes you'll be grateful and you'll say you're grateful for something. Actually, I think that works much more in the real life economy than it ever will in the economy of media and content. I don't understand thank you cards. They've said thank you. Why have they sent me a card as well? It's an irrational act. I love getting them though. Something that happens in the real world, this is the big one, something that crosses over between bits and bricks. I will absolutely pay because I have no choice and because I can see the value to go to the gig. I will pay to have the once in a lifetime experience, the thing you can't buy. I will pay to go to the live match, to have the live experience. I will pay to have the live theatrical experience. There are things which are real, there are things which are unique, there are things which can't be copied, there are things which only money can buy. And that real connection into my life that adds value, if it's learning. It's fascinating, isn't it, that the books appear to remain constant in their prices, but now we have a book tour circuit where writers turn up and hundreds of people pay money to hear them speak and to ask them questions. That's a book. Is it promotional? Yes, they probably sell a few books. But actually, I know because a friend of mine does this, she backs about £5,000 a night from it as well. There's a living in that for some people, some of the time. So the connection between the real world and the virtual is usually left way too late in debates about this territory. What is it not? Well, I don't know if this is, I'm about to get sacked or something, but it's not about commissioning content. You'll have heard this from commissioners who've given presentations, I'm sure. It's not about commissioning content for 360 degree anything. It's about integrated ideas that work across multiple platforms. Anybody who says 360 degree commissioning to you is dad dancing. They're trying to pretend they're in this world, but in fact they're bringing their old idea in and they should basically have stayed sitting down. It isn't about commissioning new content in a slightly different way, but really television with knobs on, or really a newspaper with some webby bits, because that's not how you consume it. If it's an existing brand that works in that world, I've worked on a number of them, Top Gear and Doctor Who and these sorts of things, then you've already got a centre of gravity in a particular medium, so of course you work like that. But that's not how you start nowadays. It just isn't how that starts. And it really doesn't help in the thinking, because it sort of implies that if, as long as you have a bit of everything, it'll be fine. And usually, from my experience, creating good interactive media work is about what you leave out, in the same way as making a great film is about what you leave out, in the same way as writing an essay is about what you leave out. So what are my tips for thinking about this sort of stuff? Well, where do you come to it from is very important. There's a brilliant book called Designing Interactions by a guy called Moggeridge. It's essentially a set of interviews with the creators of interactive media. One of the things they all share is they have a participant perspective. They think of it as being something I do as a user, not as something that is done to me by a piece of media. Participant perspective, really important. They're clear-eyed about platforms. They're pragmatic about platforms. Only ever do a project on a particular platform if you are being paid an eye-watering sum of money to do it on that platform by somebody, unless it works. I've done projects loads in my career now of trying to make content work on certain platforms. If it's not going to work, it's not going to work. I've got a sort of a routine here from my theatre days. I used to show some of you will have seen it. I used to show an opening DVD of two clips from the last Shakespeare play I directed, Romeo and Juliet. Not my production. One, a very old BBC production, which was a camera slowly tracking back on these dead bodies on a stage, all very black and dark, and this portentous sort of BBC Shakespeare voice saying, two households, both alike in dignity, and you could hear the seats slamming up in Scarborough, really. And the other was Baz Luhrmann's film, the opening of Baz Luhrmann's film. One of those is a film, the other is a recording of a Shakespeare play. One of those understands its medium, one of them doesn't. Being pragmatic and clear-eyed about which medium you use is central to creating anything that's going to span platforms. You won't do that if you've got this 360 degree vision. You just can't do that and pay attention to the real value of the platform. Noticeability, you've got to be found. You've got to understand how search engines work at the moment. You've got to understand how viral marketing works. You've got to understand how word of mouth works, because they will be the forces which help your work to rise or fall very, very quickly. And the life cycles of media work now are so short. Massive brands last long periods of time. But how long did Susan Boyle last in this country? An enormous flare. 100 million, 300 million YouTube views, and occasionally now in the paper. She might come back, I don't know. Might be being very well managed, but she'd flare and then go away for a period of time. Noticeability, very, very important, but it's not as important as permanence, because, or at least longevity. Because from longevity comes noticeability. The longer you're about, the more people trip over you. The more search engines find you, the more people discover what you're about. And so you've got to be around for a little while. Not least because most of the very noticeable pragmatic propositions out there that are based on the participants' perspective are actually communities. They're social networks, or they're fan groups, or they are organisations of people loosely gathered around a content organisation or a brand. They're communities, not audiences. And communities take time to build. And that's how long you need. Enough time. Of course, you never know what enough is, but it is always more than the television or print media cycle. Multi-platform projects, cross-platform projects, interactive projects take time to build. Big games titles have a lifespan of a year or more. They take 40 hours to play, some of the big ones. Television commissioners dream of 40 hours spent with a programme. Many of them dream of 40 hours spent with a channel. It's an enormously distinct, it's a very distinct space to be in. And the other thing you mustn't do, and this is the sort of closing sequence now, is you mustn't go too far. You can go too far in these ways and many others. You can believe too much in what they call the wisdom of crowds. There's a great book called The Wisdom of Crowds, another book called Here Comes Everybody by Clay Shirky. They're very interesting. It's all about the rise of what we call bottom-up mass participation media. But you can take it too far. Because the wisdom of crowds can quite rapidly become the madness of the mob. There's something very complex about the way markets and democracy work and the way that they condition themselves. Something I suspect an incoming Tory government, if there is one, is going to learn. An interesting balance between preserving things, conservatism at one level, and the rise of free market in the media age in another. Because many of the things that one hand wants to preserve are likely to get decimated by choices of mass audiences pulling together their views of what they want. That's been a plaintive cry, because it's art versus utility, the second point. That's been a plaintive cry forever. It's an elitist cry. And I make no bones about that, and I make no apology for it. Because I don't believe the crowds would have created Mozart's great mass in C minor. I also don't believe the crowds could have painted a Van Gogh. I don't believe the crowds can write Shakespeare. I do believe, however, they can tell me about things that they want. They can critique and give me information that is helpful to me as a creator. They can destroy and or make me with the things that they do and choose to do with their time. But they're not necessarily going to have the spark. The crowds don't have sparks in that way. So you can overbelieve in the wisdom of crowds. You can forget that this argument has been around forever, the art versus utility argument. Read a bit of John Stuart Mill, have a look at Wittgenstein's Aesthetics. These arguments have been around for a long time, and they will remain around us until we have sentient computers and all the other things from science fiction, and hopefully I am a disembodied head in a Matt Groening cartoon. We also need to remember that markets can undermine what we've called quality. This is a kind of plea for understanding the need to manage markets. I'm not going to use the word regulate in this context, but to manage them in some shape or form. We manage them with old-fashioned tools some of the time. Tools we use in news, for instance, around balance, impartiality. We manage them using economics by asking for consideration to be given to the dominance of a player in a particular market, whether it's telecoms or whether it's sports rights or something. But actually, we shouldn't get too dogmatic, because markets will find their level. And often that will drive innovation, but not always, and not unregulated and unstructured. We aren't hearing a debate about this really at the moment, thankfully, in the media. Maybe we'll hear it shortly. We aren't hearing it enough, I suspect, in the financial services industry for my liking. We also need to get rid of the wishful thinking. Local newspapers. Does anybody actually believe that local newspapers held local democracy to account at any time in the last 50 years? Because I don't. I believe they printed press releases and they're very valuable for all sorts of other things, but I think they may have been out there contributing to the amount of information. They may be very valuable to the primary school, but I'm not sure they were holding news to account. They were holding power to account, which I think is one of their primary functions. And if they weren't doing that, let's not put in place a solution now, which we're talking about in policy circles at Ofcom and elsewhere, to save newspapers. Let's put in place the answer to the problem, which is holding power to account, understanding how to make democracy work. And if newspapers are part of that, great. If they're not, thank you very much. Good night, Vienna. But it's not about protecting those institutions. They don't have a monopoly on the core idea. And many of them actually haven't been fulfilling that core idea for a long time. It is sacrilege for me to say it. This is not official Ofcom position, but I would apply the same logic to television local news. It needs some serious work on what it's for, not just on how it's funded. And that brings us finally to the last sort of set of wishful thinking. Regulation, safety. I'm writing a book at the moment with Professor Tanya Byron, who did a government review last year on internet safety. She, I think, brought a sort of level-headed calm to the debate about what needs to happen with social networks, what should happen with computer games and our children, not least because she said it was partly about safety and it was partly about digital literacy. If my overriding theme has been anything tonight, it's been about empowerment of us as individual users. That means we have to understand and accept that sometimes there are people out there who need protection. It would interest you to know, maybe you already know, that the number of complaints to Ofcom and the Press Complaints Commission are higher this year than any year on record, and they were last year, and they were the year before. People aren't ready for the new world necessarily of being able to look after themselves. Children and the vulnerable need to be thought about and protected in some shape or form. But actually that doesn't mean putting red ropes outside everything and saying, do not go here. There need to be spaces for risk. There need to be sensible approaches to this stuff. We need to think about it as a form of literacy. We, as participants in this big ecosystem, just as we do in the green ecosystem, need to think about the implications of what we do and what might happen as a result. Because in the end, we are heading towards empowerment. The general direction of travel is to shift the locus of control towards us, the people formerly known as the audience, because it's our attention that has to do the paying. And as long as our attention has to do the paying, we will be, to some extent, in the driving seat. And that is the end of the lecture. Thank you very much. Well, I think one person's junk is another person's car boot sale. So finding value is something that's done by an individual person at an individual level. So it's junk to me to go and look at a forum about classic cars, but it's not junk to a very great friend of mine. So one of the things I think is happening is that our kind of values and systems about how or if we bother defining good from bad are changing. I think what makes the one way of describing it is the content that has a very high signal-to-noise ratio that sticks out. And that sticks out, I think, for the same reasons it always did. It's good, it's of high quality, it's well-made, it's thoughtful, but actually increasingly it's about how open it is to interactivity. So for me, it's the question pivots on how much I, as a member of the audience or the people formerly known as the audience, can sort of adopt content and take it to be my own. I would have always done that by talking about it down the pub. But for me now, I want to talk about it wherever I want to talk about it. So there's less specific answer to the question. I think there's less content that cuts through in a given country, but there are larger projects and larger content propositions that cut through globally. Formats, big sports rights, that kind of thing. And there's masses more stuff out there, but it's of value to small niches. And the niches are really small. You can make money on a few thousand people if they're really passionate about the thing that they're a niche in. So the values are shifting around. It's over there. We've got some in the middle. I think we're recording, actually, if you don't mind.
Hi, yeah. I wonder if you're actually being a bit hard on Murdoch, and maybe he's playing a smarter game than we give him credit for. And I think part of his strategy is that he's saying, I'm trying to charge for this content and I can't make any money out of it because the BBC is giving it away for free. And so actually it's a kind of tactic to try and get rid of the BBC News website.
I fear there's some truth in what I'm deliberately being hard on Murdoch. It's a lecture, isn't it? Yeah, I think that's there's definitely some truth in that. I think there's also truth in the idea that kind of in the old world of physical distribution, enough newspapers doing something would have inflected the newspaper market. But it's way bigger than the newspaper market. I think it's also kind of interesting that it's sort of smoked Google out slightly to start saying, well, we share content, we share revenues. That's not really understood enough in the debate, actually, I think. I think where it's sort of Canutian is the idea that you just put the price on and everything and people will start paying. I mean, there are lots of examples of people who tried that and generally it utterly decimates their traffic. So if he's got a problem funding now, I don't think it's going to get vastly better. And by the way, he does have a genuine problem. News organisations have a massive genuine problem with funding what they're doing. I worked for The Guardian for years. It's shelling money out the door. Somebody in the middle a moment ago. There's another one there.
I'm wondering if you have like any comments on the recent Google Books settlement with the orphan copyright thing.
With the out of copyright stuff, yeah. Or the in copyright.
They made available like millions of orphan books.
Yeah.
Whose copyright holders are not funded. So.
I mean, temperamentally, I'm inclined to believe it's a good thing for them to have done, and. I can understand the complex dynamics of why they're doing it drives more search to Google. And there's an interesting thing about UK copyright law and, you know, what happens to an orphaned work, a work where nobody knows who really owns it. So they sort of sit on the shelf as opposed to what might happen soon. They'll just be able to be released sort of public domain. So I'm kind of in favour of opening the public domain up as much as possible and getting it online and digitised. But I'm not sure that's the same as some of the more extreme sort of positions that some of the search engines take about digitising sort of books in print and books already in copyright. I think that's a commercial problem. I don't think that's a legal problem at all. I think it's about working out who's going to pay who what. And as soon as they do that, I think they'll be fine. I think, in fact, lots of this is about the balance between how much money the search guys make and how much money the content guys make. And most of it is posturing still. And that's true of books. It's absolutely true of YouTube. You know, Susan Ball not going on YouTube was heavily about an argument between who got the money. It wasn't a point of principle about who owned the copyright. It was an argument about who got what share. And the same is true of Google Books going forwards into the copyright space. I do a little dance.
Given what you were saying about the importance of literacy and free speech and the kind production of the kind of regulatory environments that will facilitate that sort of thing, what are your views on the proposals that the government are putting forward, such as three strikes and you're disconnected?
I think there's a grain of interestingness in them, in the sense that I'm fairly confident, and I've seen research suggesting that one strike will deter a very large number of people from doing anything, but it won't fix the sort of hardcore question about piracy. I don't believe it will. I think there is then a genuine problem about the idea. The thing I have the most discomfort with it, whether it's three strikes, whatever period it is that I don't think these are administrative decisions to be made by politicians. I think there absolutely have to be proper legal processes involved in anything that involves a suspension of what I think is basically a primary service. Whether it's a human right is something for the courts to determine, but you don't suspend people's water like that, you don't suspend people's electric like that. So I think the thing that discomforted me most about the initial proposals was, as I saw them, was that they were essentially riding roughshod over that kind of protection. And I saw lots of early drafts of them for reasons to do with Ofcom and things. And you know, they veered from being worse than that than better than that, all over the place. And I think there's a value in something being done, but I think we've got to be very careful about effectively allowing the content industries to become the police on this one. I don't think that's helpful to anybody, including them, actually. I think the idea of suspension terrifies them. The interesting sub-story, which did come out in a bit of the press, was that the security services are absolutely terrified of the entire thing because they believe it will ratchet up encryption. They believe that it will drive the market for encryption technology in this country so that the really bad people out there are unfindable. And there's something in that, something deeply terrifying about that. If we're protecting the record industry at that kind of cost, I think we've got to talk to the record industry about it. There was somebody there, there's people at the back. This is the worst bit. This is much worse than giving a lecture.
Anthony, that was a great lecture. Thanks for that. I'm just interested to know, you've talked about too much stuff being out there.
Yeah.
Do you think there's still a place for people to mediate between the person and the stuff?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely do. There's a book called The Paradox of Choice, which sort of goes into that territory. Sorry, I do sound like a bibliography tonight, but I'm trying to be a professor a bit. Yeah, absolutely do. I think that's what happens at the social group level anyway. That's what we do for each other as social groups. I think you and the more you have trust and the more you believe in the authenticity of the person's voice, whether it's because you know them, because they're related to you or a close friend or whatever it is, or because you feel you have that kind of projection onto them because they're a star name or celebrity or an academic or whatever it is, I think the value of that capability to act as a filter is rising, absolutely rising. And you know, we see that to some extent in a kind of slightly dishevelled sort of way in the blogosphere. You know, some blogs rise because people are active at them, but also because they're expert, and those expert voices may not have been heard before. Now, I'm not suddenly suggesting that that's the death of, you know, that's the rise of a fifth estate or the death of the press as we know it, but there's something in there about authenticity. You find it, actually. Paradoxically, I found it most in my professional career working with the utterly uncontroversial figure of Jeremy Clarkson, because those who believe Jeremy and believe in his views on cars really believe Jeremy and his views on cars, and they search for him like mad on Google. And whatever you think about him, what you learn from that is that that is a signal in a noisy environment, and that people gather around that signal. So I think, if anything, that capability rises more than ever. I mean, who the hell's Simon Cowell 10 years ago? Why am I obsessing with Simon Cowell this evening? But, I mean, you know, it's that filtering capability. And there is talent in that. There is incredible talent in that. There really is.
I'm not a media person, and I'm very conscious of your admonition on the screen at the moment about subsequent lectures. It does seem to me that there's a tiny, tiny pachyderm just tucked over there in the corner at an inaugural lecture, which seemed to me to be absolutely a splendid lecture, and treated a whole set of issues which are particularly relevant to education. I don't think you used the word education once.
No.
You did have a slide which said it's not the content, it's the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you have any views about virtual learning environments.
Yeah, the PLC I'm involved with is in that space. I very deliberately didn't talk about it this evening, but I didn't use the word education because I prefer the word learning, because I think it's focused on the right part of the chain. So for me, the complexities in the education space, and I do a fair bit of work there, but I didn't cover it tonight, as you say, maybe next time, are all about empowering learners whilst at the same time accepting and acknowledging that there's going to be a change in the role of teachers. There is already a change in the role of teachers, but that does not mean the abolition of teachers. In the same way that there need to be changes in the way we relate the physical institution of a university or a school to the learner. Magic Lantern doesn't exist as a physical institution anymore. We disbanded the company physical presence. We get together now where we need to get together as teams and groups, and everything else happens on the move or virtually or however it can happen. To do that, you need to go to a certain place, and actually we find we like to see each other more than we do. But if you take that logic to the learning environment, you know, what are you actually saying? It's about relationships and connections between people. But there's something about trust, there's something about wisdom, there's something about experience in there. I think it's about mentoring. I think it's about supporting. But I also, I can't talk about the future of learning with Professor Heppel in the room. I mean, it's just not the right thing to do. You know, you don't hire a dog and then bark. He's gone now, I can say that. Hi.
What value do you place on information these days? You know, data is so readily available. Do we still value it the same as we did, do you think? The amount of conversations I've had recently in the pub, and everyone will get out their iPhone and Google what someone said because they don't believe them.
There's something really fascinating in that, and it sort of comes to this thing about learning as well. You know, the kind of hidden message about learning at the front of the lecture was, I can get the quote from Proust from Wikipedia. Do I need to know the date of the Battle of Hastings? No, but I do need to know why I need to know the date of the Battle of Hastings. And there's something in there about whether it's about factual data. It's back to data and knowledge and wisdom and information again. Factual data, I think you can find. But being a digital literate citizen, knowing what you need to search for, is about being a literate citizen and about being an educated citizen. And my worries are not in find and retrieve information. You know, winning pub quizzes, there's a great sequence in The Office, isn't there, about how one of the characters is brilliant at pub quizzes. He reads a book a week, and they're all pub quiz books. So there's something in there about, you know, winning pub quizzes is not necessarily going to help the world. It will, of course, be able to describe precisely all the things that went wrong as we let the world burn, but it won't help particularly. So there's a sort of thing in there about, you know, how we rebalance that notion. I think it's going to be fascinating watching the Tories struggle with it, because I think they're split if they come in. I think Labour's been split on it. Split between, back to education, but split between standards, learning, split between these ideas that are about measuring things you can measure. My worry is that if you count that much, you end up counting only the things you know how to count. You count things that are countable. And the alternative, which is finding the value in it. So for me, I don't think there was ever any value in data. But there is enormous value in knowing how to apply it, in knowing how to filter it. Back to the previous question, actually, previous question but one. How to filter it, how to find it, how to package it up in meaningful ways. And that, in a strange sort of way, that's why I'm not in this sort of conscious computers, semantic web sort of thing. I know it will occur and it become more like that as time goes on. But I still think, you know, there's more goes on in here. I really believe in people at the end of the day.
Hi. Okay, so seeing as there's so much stuff out there, I'm assuming most things have already been done. You know, trying to come up with original things is very difficult. So where is there really room for innovation? Is it in coming up with new products and new things, or is it in just representing existing products? Or is it a bit of both? You know, where can you actually work towards?
I'm sure the easy answer is it's in a bit of both. for a start, I'm never too sure about innovation as a word for its own sake. That just means new, and new isn't necessarily good. I think that there's an incredible skill in repackaging. What's that? Somebody's going to tell me now. Which poet is it that says, is it Dali or somebody, good poets plagiarise, great poets steal, or something? Is that a quote? Somebody's going to find it. Somebody Google it. But there's something in there about how, you know, how repackaging things that previously existed. You know, that's the one I'm going for, yeah. You know, and so, you know, Romeo and Juliet is based on a Renaissance poem or play or whatever it is. And there's that sort of thing about the artistic equivalent of that Newton quote, "We see further because I stand on the shoulders of giants," or whatever it is. There's something in that which, of course, is always going to be true. But there's also something about genuine sparks of just unimaginable genius.